Hello and welcome aboard the battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I'm David Bax.
Thank you for listening. David, it's late. How we doing?
It's slightly later than we usually record, but
You're a night owl, though. You won't
I
go to bed
really
for like
am.
5 hours.
It's a problem that I could be tired all day, and then when the sun goes down, I'm wide awake.
So I have a friend, well, it's really more of an acquaintance, who says in every relationship there's a vampire and there's a werewolf. And the werewolf is like constantly roaming the streets out all night, like has more of like a loosey-goosey schedule. And the vampire is like, no, I want to stay home. I want to situate myself here. I want to have a schedule. I want to have like rules to my routine. Do you and Natalie have this dichotomy?
I'm definitely more the vampire, I guess. I sorry, I just accidentally muted myself. You guys can hear me, right? Okay. Yeah, I'm definitely more the routine one. Now, what I've heard is this is a tweet that I wish I could credit, that the ideal marriage is between a person who hates pickles and another person who likes pickles.
If so, Julie
And
and I haven't made.
yeah, that's exactly what I can't stand pickles, and Natalie is like so excited. I'd never say if I order something that has pickles, I never say no pickles anymore. I say pickles on the side because I know Natalie's gonna want those pickles.
Conversely, I knew a couple who had a deal where the husband always got his wife's pickles on around the side, but she this was a trade-off that they couldn't remember what she got in return.
Worked out for him.
Yeah, but now they're getting divorced, so maybe it was the harbinger of doom.
Oh no. Yeah, I also just learned that some friends are getting divorced. It's
We're that age.
yeah, I mean, at one point it was weird that I was like, oh, it's weird that I have friends who are getting married, and then it's like, it's weird that I have friends who are having kids, and now it's like, yeah, I have friends who are getting divorced. Sad. Anyway, we have a lot to get to. I don't know if that's true, but we have a guest to
We'll
get
find
to.
out.
But first, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great, they sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Today, Scott, this will actually be of interest to you, I think, because for once,
Okay.
I'm not going to talk about metal.
Oh, thank God.
I believe that you are a fan of Caroline Polachek. Is that right?
Yes, I went to one of her concerts.
Right. Well, her most recent album, Desire I Want to Turn Into You, she, like a lot of artists do, has put out like a deluxe expanded edition of the album called the Ever
Naturally.
Asking Edition. And so today on the bus and train on the way home from work, I was rocking out to, not, I don't know, rocking out, but just gliding on the beautiful instrument that is her voice. It sounded great in my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. There was a quick break. There should have been a quick break in there, but I did everything right. And we are ready to jump into the episode proper. This is the third year in a row, I guess, that we've had this guest. He is the host of the official MUBI podcast. His name is Rico Gagliano, and he's from Pittsburgh, but he lives here now. Welcome back to the show, Rico.
That's all we
Thanks.
know about
Yeah, that sums up the sum total of our relationship over the last 3 goddamn years. That's definitely me. Yes, and it's such a pleasure to be back on. And also, I'm the reason why you guys are recording late this episode. And I apologize. It's
No, no,
speaking
no.
of friends with kids, I have a 4-year-old, and that makes me do all sorts of ridiculous things, including start recording at 9 p.m. at night when most of us would be busy doing other things. So
That's
thanks.
okay. That's okay. Obviously, we're here to talk about Russell Wilson signing with the Steelers.
Can I tell you something? I'm just going to tell you guys, this is a secret that you can bleep completely out. I'm not watching football anymore.
Yeah.
And as a Pittsburgher, that means if anybody finds out, I will be barred from ever entering probably the state of Pennsylvania, actually. I will not be allowed to be there anymore. Or if I'm allowed in, I won't be allowed to indulge in any of my favorite foods, all of which you generally consume during a football game, like or baseball game, at least pierogies, et cetera, pizza, all that's hoagies, as we call them.
Sure.
Speaking of pickles.
Armani Brothers sandwiches.
Yeah. So I'm not up on the Steelers. I'm not
the
up
salad,
on the
salad. Salad with fries on it.
Yeah. The Pittsburgh salad.
Yeah. I have kind of a similar thing with pro football. Not that I've stopped watching it, but I'm from St. Louis originally, St. Louis, Missouri. And I live in Los Angeles. So my team, the Los Angeles or the St. Louis Rams,
you just followed them around.
They followed me here, everyone, like my entire family in St. Louis, like hates the Rams now for leaving.
Yeah. It's like a Brooklyn Dodgers thing.
Yeah, I feel like kind of like I have to keep it a secret that I like secretly still like the Rams and I'm happy they're in Los Angeles because like my family hates them now.
But wait, am I remembering this wrong? But weren't they previously the LA Rams a long time ago?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Get over it.
They just came home. Yeah, yeah.
That's like a thief stealing something. This is like the British stealing stuff from their colonies, putting it in the British Museum, and then getting pissed off when people want it back.
Exactly what
happened. It's just like that.
Yeah.
There's no difference between those.
St. Louis stole and appropriated the Los Angeles Rams, rendering the plot of 1978's Heaven Can Wait indecipherable.
Oh, dude, you're right. Man,
the LA Rams in that movie.
That's right. I saw that when it came out, guys. That's how old this guy is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sorry.
I only saw it recently. Well, I mean, within the last 10 years, I saw it for the first time at TCM Classic Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
They had the now late Buck Henry and Diane Cannon introduce the film.
Oh, man.
And Ben Mankiewicz was talking about the... how the story that Heaven Can Wait is that it's like, you know, it's Here Comes Mr. Jordan. He was talking about all the different like things. And he was like, Chris Rock even made one that wasn't bad. And Buck Henry was like, So yeah, Buck Henry was Buck Henry to the end.
Hey, just real quick, since we're like going off on massive tangents all over the place,
course,
we're recording this a couple of days after the Oscars, and Annette Bening was there. She's still married to lady. Where was
Warren? You want me to put in a good word?
Was Warren still there? Speaking of Heaven Can Wait, was Warren at the Oscars?
That's
no, she was seeing somebody else.
Yes, what's up with that?
I mean, Warren's been to the Oscars like a billion times. Maybe he's just like, I'm old. No thanks.
Really? If you're Warren Beatty, it seems like the Oscars are where you were born to be. Like that's your dojo.
I would think so. I don't know. He's also just a weird guy. You ever heard him speak?
No.
I've seen him at two Q&As and he was super weird at both and it was great.
Yeah, I saw him.
Just like speaking of tangents, like it's just nothing but tangents. Like someone will ask a question and he'll go on like a 15-minute answer that has nothing to do with the question itself. Hmm. Just talking about like restaurants he likes and like things that might have happened during the shoot that have nothing to do with the movie. It's a blast.
The only time I've seen him in person was at TCM Classic Film Festival. He introduced Leonard Maltin, if that makes sense, because Leonard Maltin was winning the getting the Robert Osborne Award that they give out every year, and they usually have someone famous introduced them. So Warren Beatty introduced Leonard Maltin, but he stayed on topic. So okay, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm guessing he had a teleprompter for that.
Sure. Yeah.
One hopes.
I've seen Leonard Maltin speak a million times. He's a delight. But okay. So 2 years ago, you came on and we talked about movie theater memories. And last year, we talked about needle drops.
Yep.
This year, these topics are tied to the topic of each year's season or each season of the movie podcast.
Yes, each season is about a different topic. Yes.
So tell us about this. Tell us about this new season of the movie podcast and what we're going to talk about today.
We just wrapped it up, and it was film and fashion, which I will say is not. And if people could see me right now, you would laugh. Definitely. I have a scraggly beard going right now. I have a Walker Architectural Workshop t-shirt that I've had for 15 years that you can literally see my nipple through, even though it's gray. That's how much it's been washed. The only stylish thing about me, which you guys can see, are my glasses, which I do enjoy. They are my very large sort of Hollywood producer style glasses. But other than that, I would not call myself a fashionable dude. And if anything, like one of the people we interviewed for this season, which would be Kevin McDonald, who just put out a documentary about the fashion designer John Galliano, he told me what I will tell you, which is that I would have thought that it's not really something, not only that I'm not kind of part of, but that something is perhaps, and this I say this with chagrin, because I don't want to seem like I'm talking down to this whole faction of the world anymore, but I'll admit it, like it's kind of beneath me, like it's you know, shallow. By nature, I think the first flush of thinking about fashion is that it is shallow because by its nature, it's the thing that you put on top of yourself. It is literally the cover underneath which we're supposed to find the book. But what's been fascinating about doing this season has been that it is in some ways actually our most serious season. Like it deals with the most sort of touchy and thorny issues. I found myself like working harder at this season and worrying more about putting the episodes together, because it turns out that when you start talking about fashion, you really start talking about identity. And I'm not sure, maybe on some level I meant to do this, but I only realized it after we were doing it, that the movies that we picked like really do, like we started with the with Breathless, because it is such a foundation of kind of modern fashion in a lot of ways for a lot of fashion designers. But it's real, like you look at that movie and then it's all about like feminism and like gender identity and kind of, you know, women's liberation. It comes out in 1959, or I think it's 1959, right? Breathless? I think it's 59. 60. I should know this. Maybe 60, it's being made in 59. So it's literally right on the cusp of the 50s and 60s. And you could argue that this movie is like one of the visual representations of the shift that is about to happen in the 60s.
Totally.
And it's like, it's been really fascinating. We did Do the Right Thing, which ends up being, of course, about kind of race and issues of police brutality and stuff like that. And they kind of wear that on their sleeves in a lot of ways. There's like subtle stuff going on in the costuming that gets into a lot of the kind of like racial politics of that era. And then we did Quadrophenia, which we didn't hit this as hard, I must say, in that episode, but it is a lot. Quadrophenia, the movie, is about the mods, and mod is really in a lot of ways a working class. This is something I think in America we don't quite get, but it starts in England as this very working class mainly kind of thing. I mean, probably at the very beginning it wasn't, but it very quickly became kind of a working class thing, starting in the late 50s and early 60s. So there's that kind of thing running underneath that as well. And then we also did a bit about Sofia Coppola, because she just put out Priscilla, and we did kind of like a career retrospective of her, and all like the fashion is hugely important in all of her movies, and the subtext of all of that stuff is kind of like women trying to establish their identity in worlds where they don't have a lot of opportunity to do so, and fashion turns out to be one of the ways that that happens in a lot of these movies. So that's a long way of saying you should listen to it, because there's some deep shit going on.
But let's get into it, shall we? Let's talk about film and fashion here. Now, hearing you just describe the season, you took, I think, probably a more interesting, but the opposite tack that I was thinking about this in, whereas I was thinking more about fashion designers, like people who, I guess the big example that you think of is Giorgio Armani and American Gigolo. Armani kind of made his name by making those, and also like you were talking about Breathless representing a new wave, like Richard Gere and America Gigolo kind of like represented the new wave of what like the GQ man was going to look like, you know, for the next decade or right. so. So I was thinking about fashion designers coming to movies.
That'd be legit. That's a totally legit way of doing it. I mean, the nature of our show has always been that like every episode is a movie and you kind of take the movie as the object lesson through which you derive things. And there are cases where you could talk about, like there was a while where we were thinking that we were going to do Breakfast at Tiffany's because of the little black dress,
but that's someone, that's Givenchy, right? That's another one where it's an established fashion.
Yes.
An established fashion designer coming to the movies, as opposed to someone like, you know, an established like Edith Head, like fashion designer. That's great too.
Right.
But I'm always really fascinated because unlike you, I'm not entirely a neophyte here. I do kind of care about fashion or at least style. And I'm a long time GQ subscriber. So I kind of know what's up, but yeah, but this is Battleship Retention, which means we can talk about whatever the fuck we want. We can go all over the place. The first thing that came to mind when you said this, because of the way that I was thinking about it, I think the first time I saw a movie in which I knew the name of the fashion designer who had, you know, stooped, if you will, to sullying their name by making costumes for a movie was Jean-Paul Gaultier and The Fifth Element.
That's right.
Because Mia Jovovich was a model before she was an actor, and there are a lot of models in that movie who pop up throughout Mia Jovovich's colleagues and friends and stuff. But that was the first time that I remember like knowing. I knew for some reason I knew who Jean-Paul Gaultier was, and I knew going in like, okay, these costumes are made by someone who is coming from a different world than the cinema world, and expressing themselves through that. And I think, I mean, Mia Jovovich's like orange and white thing has become like iconic, so I guess it worked.
Yeah, I mean, like my question to you would be, what did that bring to the experience for you, knowing, like, were you aware of his work before that came in, before that movie?
I think I was more just aware of the name. I don't think at that time I would have been able to like describe what Jean-Paul Gaultier's style was, but I knew the name. And so I guess this is 97. It was probably 98 when I saw it. So I'm like 15, 16 years old. I was probably simply because I knew that an established fashion designer was making costumes, I was probably paying more attention to the costumes than I would have in other movies at that age.
So now it's not so much that it was like, it's not so much like, oh, I wonder how this vision is going to get morphed into this film vision. It's more like, oh, well, this guy is a somebody in the world of fashion, so I'm going to pay attention to what he does here.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But and especially in that movie, because it's so outrageous. I can also imagine that sculpting one's vision of what costume design is and what high fashion is. And I do think that there's something interesting about that, because high fashion often is just skirting right on the edge, sometimes like plummeting willingly over the edge into the cinematic, into a world, into something that is like a total flight of fancy that doesn't seem to have any grounding in like the actual world where you would wear clothes.
But I also think it's a thing, and this is getting away from movies and into more fashion, but there's a thing like avant-garde filmmakers like Godard, as we mentioned, like and Scott and I did a whole literally 5-hour episode about Godard after he died.
He would have loved that, by the way.
One of the things I remember talking about is that like you see this sort of avant-garde filmmaking, this new ways of editing and making film, and yet they all end up getting, if they're effective, they end up getting packaged and commercialized. You know, you see like fucking like Levi's commercials that look like Terrence Malick or look like an approximation of Terrence Malick, that sort of thing. And I think a similar thing happens And it's kind of like, I don't think we can do this episode without at least mentioning The Devil Wears Prada, which I do is a movie that I have a lot of problems with, but as someone who does think that fashion as an art form is something that should be taken seriously, there are a lot of elements with that movie that I like. Specifically, I love Miranda Priestley's speech after Anne Hathaway like giggles about the belt or whatever, and is she it, has this entire
isn't it the blue sweater?
Yeah, she giggles about a belt, and then Miranda Priestley points out her blue sweater and like gives this storyline of like how these things start at high fashion and trickle down and show up and end up informing what you buy at, you know, Target or Marshalls or whatever in a year. And so I think that's one way in which like fashion and movies both being kind of vulgar art forms have something in common, that like the avant-garde part of it still ends up informing the commercial part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that. We did Do the Right Thing, and I'll be honest, I really wanted to do the Right Thing because I didn't know that there would be something, it would be a way of talking about something that seems frivolous and we'd get at something serious underneath it. But I also worried, and I worried about with a lot of these things, actually, that it would be like, oh, you're going to do the Right Thing, this incendiary movie that deals with like only one of the most salient issues in modern America, you know, like race and police violence and stuff. But you're going to talk about the clothes. I get it. But what's fascinating is that the end of that episode, and I didn't mean this to happen, but I talked to I'm gonna blow his name, I can't remember, a really great scholar, go and listen to the episode, you'll hear him, who was talking about, you know, in all of these episodes, this kind of like this movie does, in a lot of the episodes of our show, the movie comes out and then it has this impact on society, and it's like talking about that movie, it's not just the fashion. That movie had this huge impact, and at the time it was so, in so many ways, like out there. No movie was like it, and it caused such an uproar, and there were critics, not just conservative critics, there were like serious like left-wing liberal good liberal critics who were like, this movie is going to start riots, like this incredibly condescending attitude, this worry about the kind of like Black people getting together and somehow seeing this movie and it like causing like them like burning the place down, like that kind of stuff. It was like really a horrible kind of things. And talk about a rebellious movie, like a gutsy movie, a movie that like really makes this like avant-garde impact. And the scholar was kind of like, yeah, the nature is that everything that is new hits and then is usually immediately criticized and someone's or tried to be dismissed out of hand or something like that. And then over time, though, this weird happens where society tries to, the term that he used was domesticate the rebelliousness, you know. Yeah. We've all heard about this with the commodification of dissent kind of thing. And it did strike me, and I said this to him, it's like, is one of the ways that that can happen is in fashion. If you take the look of something that is outrageous and then you fold it into something that actually then you can package and sell and turn it into something that's trendy, and then everybody's wearing it and now it's lost its teeth.
Oh, did you see Todd Solondz's wiener dog?
No.
I know exactly the moment you're going to reference.
Well, Danny DeVito plays a film professor, I think.
Kind of professor for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like a screenwriting professor, I think. Anyway, he's got a bunch of hipster students, and one of them is this white girl, like lounging around the student lounge, looking as hip as possible in her I Can't Breathe t-shirt. And it just like, without even it being verbally commented on, that's exactly what Todd Solondz is like pointing out, is this is just fashion for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think both of what you guys are talking about is, I think that's something that gets reflected in actually The Devil Wears Prada, which is like this push and pull that movies that are about fashion have to undergo, where it's like, they want to take it seriously, but also want to acknowledge the kind of emptiness that surrounds it. And that's my problem with Devil Wears Prada, is it like takes the fashion seriously until it suddenly doesn't, and it's like, no, she's better off leading a real life. But like, you see that reflected in tons of movies that are directly about like the fashion world. I mean, Phantom Thread was the first one that came to mind. But like House of Gucci has a little bit of that too. Even like Funny Face, which I think is a little bit more like on the side of like fashion is art. But there's an element of that in there. The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant. Great movie about a fashion designer, but it like, and the whole point is her life is empty. Or the same thing in Neon Demon, pretty recent movie. But that's another movie that's like, there's just this like empty void that everyone's projecting fashion into.
Yeah, that's it's interesting too, because one of our episodes is about Sofia Coppola and like her whole career. The one movie that she's made that is most specifically about fashion, that the characters are talking about fashion constantly and they lust after fashion consciously, is like her one satire.
That's
Bling Ring.
Yeah.
And it is exactly like they're after this like vapid thing. In her case, what she's saying is that that is the kind of fashion that they're after is really a fashion that is about wearing the fashion. It's like they don't want it because of its beauty. They want it because it implies a status. They want, the way somebody put it was, they want the thing that has the biggest CC on it, not the most well-made, beautiful piece of clothing, which is what Sofia Coppola would be about. But it's still interesting. It's really true that it's like when you put, it's like a shorthand for vapidity, the fashion world.
But it's interesting you bring up the, to dovetail, to go back to Do the Right Thing. I when you said Do the Right Thing, I was like, that's perfect. I didn't have any of the qualms about like that you were, you know, that it's a superficial way of approaching it. Like the fashion to Do the Right Thing, the costumes, everything about Do the Right Thing is like Spike Lee taking something that a part of America that at that point was like usually depicted, I'm talking about like lower income black neighborhoods and cities, usually depicted with a sheen of like liberal guilt and performative like grittiness or whatever, and making it so full of color. But it's not just so full of color in the fashion, it's also full of like brands and brand names, and so that status symbol, it's very different when these like layabout children of rich parents break into Paris Hilton's house to steal her Coco Chanel thing. That's a different status symbol than Giancarlo Esposito's Nike's getting scuffed, because like that, a status symbol to someone who is on the lower rungs of society economically and socially and culturally, unfortunately, those status symbols mean something different. The scene where Giancarlo Esposito, I know his name is supposed to, is really memorable, the character
bugging out
it's not just anyone who scuffs his sneakers, it's the white gentrifier. That's perfect.
It is interesting, we talked about that scene in that episode with a couple of people, and the scholar I talked to, he actually, it's interesting the way that sneakers are used in that movie, because I mean, it's fascinating in general. Like Spike Lee is a guy who was at that time a spokesperson for Nike, kind of still is. He's still brought in every now and then to be a spokesperson for Nike, and made all those Air Jordan commercials with the cinematographer of Do the Right Thing, Ernest Dickerson. So it's like he loves those things, and he got a ton of them for product placement on a smoothie, for sure. I'm sure it's one of the ways that they were able to make the movie. But it's like, they, first of all, it's interesting because they had all that stuff, it influenced the nature of the costumes, because Ruthie Carter, who we spoke to, was like, those were these bright sports team colors, so I had to come up with colors that went with that. But that worked out because the vision of the movie was a kind of non-traditional view of things. It was like an over-the-top vision in some ways visually, that movie, so it kind of worked together. But also the way that he talks about Nikes in those films, in that scene, there are those who would say that he's criticizing Buggin' Out, because especially Buggin' Out, he's otherwise dressed as a, like what you would say a black activist would be dressed in. He's got a shirt with a kente cloth stripe on it. Right. He's got he's got an Africa leather medallion and another kind of like similarly like a sort of African nationalist medallion. He's got dreads and all this stuff, and he models himself as an activist, but he cares super much about this object. That's the thing that he's like expending all his energy on. And this one scholar was taking him to task for that. But then at the same time, when Radio Raheem is killed, right before he dies, the last shot you get of him right before he dies is his feet kicking in air, midair, and it's his sneakers. And this is at a time when there was starting to be all this brouhaha about how black people were killing each other for their sneakers, except that here's a black kid getting killed by a cop.
Right.
And it's like, oh, you're so worried about black kids killing each other for sneakers. Where's your outrage over this? And the type of sneakers that he's wearing are Nike Air Revolutions.
Oh, wow.
Like, literally, like, there's a lot going on with the shoes in that movie. They're picked for very specific reasons.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think Spike Lee is someone who like phones anything in aesthetically.
No, for sure. So, but it was cool as I was like getting into like, and I'll also be honest, like when I looked it up, I was like, what are those sneakers? And it's like, oh, Revolutions. Good God.
Yeah.
That is, you couldn't ask for anything better as someone writing an essay about this.
I feel like we could do a whole episode on Do the Right Thing, but you already did. So,
that's right. Sorry.
I don't know. What are some, well, I guess, Scott, let me ask you, when I told you what this topic was going to be, where did your mind first go?
Definitely like depictions of the fashion world in film. So like a few of the films I mentioned, plus, Zoolander, frankly, came to mind pretty quickly.
Right.
In terms of like, and honestly, I think like it has the same thing I'm talking about, where like, it's about this guy who's purely vapid learning to figure out something a little bit more about his life and himself. And like, you see that reflected in so many different films about the fashion world. Even Blow Up really is kind of about that. Like, it's about this photographer who's just living like the kind of vapid, like 60s swinging London lifestyle, right. Because he's a fashion photographer, and gradually as he like starts to feel like he might have uncovered this murder, uncovering like also a greater purpose in his life and a greater like meaning in the world and grappling with the emptiness of that. So yeah, it was interesting to see how much that central theme like reflected, and there's all these films that like try to deny it, but then try to wrestle with it. But that seemed to be like pretty thoroughly the central theme of fashion movies.
It is fascinating. Good. It's interesting too that, in both like Quadrophenia and Blow Up, made in two very different eras, but about the same era, you know, the early 60s mm-hmm. mod, kind of their mid to early 60s mod movement. Both of them are movies that people in the mod movement really admire. Like, they really love it.
Totally.
They go to it and they dig the fashions. But the message of both of those movies is these are like tribes. Everybody's dressing, trying to like dress the same or outdo each other with their dress. And really, you should think for yourself. Like, really, this is that is a surface thing. Maybe you should go a little bit deeper. Like, life, there is more to life than these things. But it's fascinating that even so, and like, by the way, I'm kind of one of these people, as much as I'm not kind of a, you know, a snazzy dresser, I do really love the mod aesthetic. And if I'm given a chance to dress up, I'm trying, that's what I'm going for. So I do kind of like watching Blow Up and Quadrophenia for their fashions, even though they're critical of these fashion movements.
Yeah. I mean, I think like that's getting to the point of the films, and also has been part of their enduring appeal is like, that's how you get people in the door kind of thing of like, it's just cool to watch people in that world with those kind of clothes and feel like you're a part of it for a little bit. But then I guess as a bonus, you get a little life contemplation along the way.
Yeah. Is that the idea? Is that the way that we get us in the door? Or is it like filmmakers having it both ways? It's kind of like, oh, I'm critiquing this, but you know what? It's pretty sexy. I mean, like, it's an aesthetic medium, right? Like,
yeah, I think it's both. It's like, I think filmmakers are as susceptible to that impulse as audiences are of like finding it appealing, but kind of wanting to dig under it as well.
I think of drug movies in the same way.
Sure. Yeah, totally. Or mob movies. Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. I guess like almost any movie that's showing kind of an underworld, it's like pretty sexy, isn't it? But no.
Yeah. But don't go too far. Yeah. I mean, really any kind of like decadence, like, I mean, that's why this is almost a whole separate topic, but just like the idea of depiction and endorsement is like a constant debate in cinephile circles and in society at large of just like, I tend to be on the side of like, get all the negative impulses out on screen and we're all the better for society. But I know there's some, and there's, you know, evidence to support it, that's like, you put too much of that in film and it'll leak out in the real world. And, you know, to a degree, you could say kind of obsession with fashion has been both a product of and interrogated by movies along the way.
Yeah. What do we...
Oh. I'm just trying to, like, what are the movies that take fashion seriously as a subject or as an art form or whatever? Because, I mean, like, Scott, you were talking about the vapidness around it. You're talking about interrogation of it. But, like, I'm trying to think of movies other than, like, I guess there's, like, biopics of, like, Christian yeah. Dior, and there's, like, documentaries about Vogue. But, like, I'm trying to think of movies that, like, actually take fashion seriously.
It's weird because the first thing that came to mind was documentaries, the September issue.
That's supposed to be good. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
It's good. There's, and yeah, I mean, like, the John Galliano, the new movie High and Low. I mean, talking to Kevin McDonald, it's interesting. Like, his ultimate takeaway is that, like, yes, this is art. It's not just craft. It is art because John Galliano is making yeah. stuff that comes from inside him. But weirdly, I can't think of fiction.
The only thing I can think of, and I never actually saw the movie, but I watched the entire series, is Sex and the City.
Sure.
Where I do think that, like, yeah. the show doesn't, like, mock Sarah Jessica Parker for being into, you know, cutting edge fashion, and does take it seriously as a passion of hers, or even just a hobby. That's the thing. I'm not saying it takes it seriously in the sense of being, like, po-faced about it. I'm saying it takes it seriously in the fact that sense that it just doesn't mock it or doesn't apologize for it. But that's just the show. I don't know. Maybe the movies go the other way. I haven't seen
the movies. I have two examples at least. One, I mean, I mentioned that Funny Face kind of tries to have it both ways, but the ultimate ending of that is that she rebukes, like, the beat poet society movement of the time and, like, embraces the fashion world. So that's kind of more on the side of fashion. And then more recently, Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho ends with, like, a fashion show being, like, the ultimate culmination of its protagonist's, like, mental well-being.
Yeah, that's that. I forgot about that part of Last Night in Soho. That's great. And I wonder if, like, that's if, like, Project Runways has had a positive effect on how people.
Maybe, yeah.
Because I mean, just anecdotally, I know Tyler, like, has said, like, he never had any interest in watching Project Runway, and then he watched the season with his wife, and he was like, "Oh, this is a show about artists.
Yeah,
I'm into this." Like, just because I don't, like, know about fashion, like, this is a show about artists creating.
What about Velvet Goldmine? In a way,
that's a good one. Long.
Yeah.
And it's interesting if I'm thinking about, like, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I mean, like, that's definitely a movie where fashion is super important. And I wonder if there are more movies where it's kind of like the putting on of clothes and sometimes, like, outre or unusual, like, as determined by society, clothes is a way of establishing yourself. It's a way, in that case, you know, it might be a means of coming out or something like that, in which case there's only a positive association with it, you know. I'm trying to think. There must be other examples of that.
Yeah.
I mean, Velvet Goldmine is definitely an interesting one because it does kind of, like, interrogate to a degree, like, I don't know if the vapidness is the right word, but there is, like, a false front that we end up finding kind of behind the major musical artists at the time. But at the same time, Christian Bale kind of ends the movie, like, very nostalgic for that period and, like, really regretting seeing that kind of passing by. So I would say that is one that definitely takes the fashion seriously, even if it, like, acknowledges the other side.
Yeah. Or maybe in the same era ish, Last Days of Disco. I remember
it's
the
been
ending.
A while.
Yeah. But I remember the very last scene of Last Days of Disco is almost them literally saying people are going to look back on this and think that it was vapid, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
There was something serious going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd also say that some of the films that kind of take fashion seriously are the ones that maybe aren't having it as its central subject and just, like, embrace it as a natural stylistic element that we all agree is great to watch and says something about the characters. I mean, at least all of the Wong Kar-wai films that I've seen kind of do this.
Oh, that's true. We did really think hard about doing In the Mood for Love.
Yeah. I mean, that in 2046, but it, like those are the ones especially, I would say. But his other films too, like all the costuming says so much about the characters and is so essential to how we understand them. But it's not about what they're wearing, but it also is kind of about what they're wearing. Like it's impossible to come away from those movies and not like think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true of a lot of like a certain type of cool director, you know, like Jim Jarmusch, a lot of his characters like look really cool.
And even like as much as he kind of gets dogged on sometimes, but Wes Anderson, like he takes the fashion his movie seriously and influenced the fashion of a whole generation, you know?
Absolutely. And by the way, it was like we should do a Wes Anderson movie, but it's also like which one do you pick?
Yeah.
And also once you go there, how do you, you know, with a lot of these movies you can pick out the things that were, you know, the one iconic thing or the few iconic things, and it's like every shot.
Yeah.
Like how do you even break that down at a certain point? But yeah, that's actually a really good thing too. Like it's more like if you use, it's almost like if you're setting something in the fashion world, probably you are making a statement about surfaces. That's
yeah, very true.
Probably your game. So that's not the place to go if you want, actually, weirdly, a serious treatment of the fashion world. It's probably not a movie about the fashion world. Although I guess I don't know why that has to be, but I think that maybe it is.
Yeah. Did either of you see Michael Winterbottom's Greed?
If you
didn't, don't rush out. It's not very good.
Perfect.
But in that movie, Steve Coogan plays a guy who has made his fortune off of like fast fashion, as we call it now, like H&M, Zara, Uniqlo, Shine, these things that are just like churning out using, you know, inhumane sweatshop labor and fuzzy math to like just churn out shit clothes that approximate what stylish people are wearing. And I would say the movie as a like an analysis of how that kind of business works is interesting. It's just not a good movie otherwise. But that gets back to the thing that I'm talking about the status symbol and about like House of Gucci gets into this, like the knockoffs. It is a part of someone's identity to be aspirational, you know, and buy something that looks like an actual designer thing or you know, tricks people into thinking it is that. And I think that's what I keep coming back to, are these status symbol things. Obviously we talked about Do the Right Thing. Another one that a movie that I think of all the time because I worked in Beverly Hills, Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's been a while since I've seen the whole movie, but my wife and I say like big mistake, huge. We say that to each other all the time because the scene she goes into, I can't remember if they ever say what it is, but it's like a Marc Jacobs.
I don't think so.
Like yeah. It's like a fancy one of those things that lines Rodeo Avenue, Rodeo Drive. God.
Yeah.
I just say Rodeo. I literally work a block from there. I should know. She goes in and the shop girls or whatever are like looking down at her because she's like clearly not a sophisticate. She's clearly like, you know, lower class. And so she says, big mistake, huge. And then she comes back with Richard Gere. And that's like, so like being taken seriously at these kind of stores are like, it's a symbol. Like that's her sort of, Richard Gere is her passport into this aspirational life, which I think is like, you could say like people were saying about Bugging Out, like that's shallow. But I think there's so much more tied up into it class-wise about being aspirational, about your appearance.
Another one on my list.
That's where else I was going to.
Well, in that same vein, another one on my list was Personal Shopper. The Olivia Sayas movie with Kristen Stewart. It's about a young woman who works as a kind of personal shopper for a big either movie star, I think movie star, But she just like goes to very high end boutiques and picks out the clothes that she's going to wear. And the clothes are just borrowed so that the boutique can get the publicity bump by this huge star wearing them. And it becomes about like Kristen Stewart kind of like having an odd relationship with that adjacency to fame, where she's like part of that world, but apart from it too, and wanting to have the clothes for herself as an entry point into that world. And I mean, it's a fantastic film.
It really is. Yeah. It was on my list of top 10 movies of the 2010s.
Nice.
Dude, yeah. That goes immediately on my list then.
Yeah. What else did we think of when we thought of this? I was looking up to confirm that Wes Anderson grew up with privilege, and yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure somehow it wasn't surprised. An aspirational thing for him. He's more like a Vampire Weekend. Like I remember when you know 2007, 2008, I was on like style forum or Ask Andy about closed message boards. This is like how into like men's style I was at the time. And like these old like fuddy duddies were like, who's this new band Vampire Weekend? Because they were dressed like Ivy League preppies, not because they liked the music, but because they had like J. Paul socks or whatever. Yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but just like, but that's a similar thing where they're not like, you know, they're not like, you know, the term low heads, you know what a low head is?
No.
So there's, it's mostly Black Americans who are obsessed with Polo by Ralph Lauren. That's
what
Low comes from. And that, like, you know, Ralph Lauren, like, think about the fact that, and this is something that's bothered me for years, that like whenever we use the term Americana, we are usually talking about like rural white America. Mm. And so like city dwelling Black people wearing these like basically reappropriating it for themselves, like that's what low heads are. Anyway, Vampire Weekend is not that. They're just from that.
They're just movie. Those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, it is also, it's fascinating that it's something that I hadn't realized. Sorry that I keep going back to Do the Right Thing, but it's just like, this was somewhat revelatory to me because I was around at the time, but not aware of it consciously. But I remember seeing it, was that when that movie comes out, there's kind of like multiple things going on in that world. Where on one hand you've got the, you know, hardcore hip hop of is coming out, and there's a lot of like Raiders jackets and like, you know, Raiders caps and that kind of stuff. Gold chains are also happening. But then you also have this concurrent preppy look that is part of what you're talking about. The low heads, I'd forgotten about them. But also if you just look at like a different world, there's kind of like a, like slightly more like colorful, I guess, yeah, preppy style that was happening. That's obviously aspirational. It's kind of like we're taking the most white, literally Ivy League college look and appropriating it and kind of like changing it somewhat for ourselves. But then what Do the Right Thing is touching upon is something that's about to follow right on the heels of that, which is the Afrocentric kind of style, which is always kind of around, but is like a comment. It's kind of like, yeah, we're not actually going to go to the aspirational white look at all. In fact, we're going to go to the mother country, Africa, rejecting everything and using that look, you know, kente cloth and dashikis and all that kind of stuff, which is actually traditionally over many decades been the outfit that you go to when you are making a protest, interestingly, in white America. Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting seeing how all these things then like play into each other and are happening at the same time. That's also, it's like we think of fashion as a series of trends, but they're actually constantly in conversation with each other, and movies have to pick and choose a lot of times.
You reminded me of something with the we were talking way earlier about when like fashion that does mean something to people like the I can't breathe shirt or whatever, loses its meaning and it's just worn as whatever. I can't remember the name of which song it is, but Eminem has a song about like wearing like an Africa medallion as a kid because he was just like the rappers that he liked were wearing them, so he wore like and didn't even know. And then at the mall, like getting accosted by, like he says, "Yeah, you ain't even half black. We're gonna have to snatch that and taking his necklace off him."
That's not for you, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Fascinating. The thing that first came to mind when I started contemplating this whole thing was Saturday Night Fever, which I briefly talked about at the beginning of the season, but like really could be an entire, you know, many episodes about like disco fashion and where that came from. You look like you're about to say something, David.
Well, it has nothing. I guess, is Saturday Night Fever like, I guess it's in conversation, but was like Saturday Night Fever like taking what was already being worn and putting it on screen, or did it inform what was being worn at the clubs, or is it?
I think, and this is also, I mean, that's a question for almost any movie that you talk about, like which came the chicken and egg question of like, does the movie make the fashion or does the film follow the fashion? And I think in that it's probably both, because where is disco happening? It's like mainly New York. It's like in gay dance clubs. It's probably in mostly like major cities and things like that. So that's where the style probably comes from. But it's out there for sure. And then the movie is set in that world and transmits it out to the universe. And I mean, that movie really transmitted. I definitely remember I lived in West Virginia at the time, in a college town, but nonetheless, West Virginia. And it was like, whoa, what is that? I have no idea what that is supposed to be. That is not what we are wearing here. And like white suits, suddenly white, that became the thing. It was like, if you want to be hip, then you wear something like flashy and white, like the white suit.
I just reminded myself of one of my favorite stories about movies actually impacting fashion in a direct way. In It Happened One Night, Clark Gable unbuttons his shirt and he's not wearing an undershirt, and sales of men's undershirts plummeted in the U.S. after that movie came out.
Really? It's the opposite. It's the anti-fashion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like taking off clothes. That's also interesting to me in movies, is when like not wearing something. It's like the thing that I realized in Priscilla, the new Sofia Coppola movie, that was fascinating. It's like I realized that in my mind, I always imagine liberation looking like somebody putting something on, like, or, and usually putting something on that is a little bit outrageous. And I've probably associated that even back to my early days when I started getting out of pop music and into punk music. It's like, you know, you're not dressing to be stylish. You're dressing to be like, screw you style. I'm going to go my own way.
You're literally like sewing a patch onto your jacket that says, makes a statement. You're putting something on. Yeah.
Right. Or ripping your clothes apart or whatever, like doing something that is like the opposite of fashion or whatever it is. But, you know, Grease, I remember as a little kid, like, what does Sandy do to like get in tight with John Travolta? She like throws away her like workaday clothes and puts on a leather jacket and like frizzes up her hair and all that crap. But it is interesting when the idea like liberation in Priscilla comes with her taking like chilling out. She's been dressing like Elvis, and her outfits have been getting more and more outrageous, just like Elvis's. But in the last part of the movie, she's suddenly like taking all the color, the black out of her hair. Her eyeliner gets dimmed down. She starts wearing pants instead of dresses. She's wearing just like a blouse top instead of like huge blue outfits.
Stuff.
That is curious to me, and I'm going to start looking for it more because I think that it's out there.
That's great. Yeah. We keep coming back to Sofia Coppola, rightfully. Yeah. Tyler and I just did our top 10 movies of 2023 episode a couple weeks ago, and Priscilla was on mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved it.
Tell me what, because the reason why I think that's germane to this conversation is that that movie is told almost like the story is almost told with costumes in a lot of ways. Were you aware of it at the time?
Because so many of the aesthetic choices, because Priscilla up until the end is not someone who speaks up for herself. A lot of times everything around her is telling us what's going on or instructing her as to what her life is supposed to be. all the time. So yeah, Sofia Coppola is clearly someone who thinks about this stuff.
For sure, a lot. Yeah. It has since she was a little kid, apparently. I'm trying to think of like anything. I mean, I feel like I haven't seen it in forever, but you know, it's called The Red Shoes.
Sure.
I'm feeling like there must be, and also like The Earrings of Madame Duh.
There's like a lot of that one.
I saw it back in film school, but it's like there are movies where it's like an item of clothing is the reason. I mean, I'd love to also see somebody do a deep dive into like Dorothy's red slippers. Like why?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Red. Why sequins? Ruby. Ruby red seems to be a lot in there. And then there's like the little black dresses throughout history. Which has always been fascinating to me because it's like, it's hard to imagine a time when something that simple would be such a big deal and trying to wrap your head around it. And it's like the idea, again, it's almost like what I was just talking about. Like my understanding is that the reason why that was a big deal is because in Breakfast at Tiffany's, she's coming out, and I'd forgotten about this until I started thinking about it. Audrey Hepburn's first scene, she's coming out of a taxi cab after having been out all night, and she's wearing a little black dress, and she still looks awesome. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you could still, in the morning, after having not slept at all and after like partying all night long and gone to obviously a very fancy shindig, you could then come out and have like a bagel. I can't remember what she has. She like steps out of the cab and has like some sort of like very minor breakfast food. I think at Tiffany's, and you'd still look awesome. Like in the middle of the morning, that thing is going to work for you. That idea of like malleability and being able to travel between worlds or something, somehow being allowed with this dress, is fascinating to me.
Yeah. Other iconic, looks. Well, here's the one that the Scorpion bomber jacket in Drive is something that only Ryan Gosling can wear and no one else should try.
Yeah, good to learn. Yes.
We should probably like look to wrapping up a couple of things we didn't mention. We weirdly didn't mention Tom Ford at all, a fashion designer who has directed movies.
I wanted to get to him.
I never saw A Single Man, but I saw Nocturnal Animals.
Oh, I like A Single Man. I mean, it's much better than Nocturnal Animals. I think it was Glenn Kenny, when A Single Man came out, described it more as like, he's like, I hate the term artsy, but this is really the only film that kind of fits that term of like, it's just kind of appropriating a look. But I think it's got some meat under the bones, and it helps this adapter from a great novel. But you can definitely tell it's got the eye of a fashion designer kind of behind it.
And then another movie we didn't talk about, and maybe because I don't like this movie, maybe I should have just let it, let it sit. But we didn't talk about Ready to Wear or
I've never seen it.
Possibly, I don't know. Maybe I'm just being reflexive and hyperbolic in the moment. But possibly my least favorite Robert Altman movie.
I think it's a lot of people, so it's not strange.
Yeah. Okay. I think because it is a movie that is set in the fashion world that doesn't seem to have any real curiosity about it, and does kind of just is content to look down on it.
Is it also, am I remembering this right, but did it come out right after like Shortcuts, like after that run where it was like,
it was definitely after. I don't know if it was right after, but
it might have been, because it's 94 and if the Shortcuts.
Oh, then yeah, it was.
Yeah, so it is right after. Yeah.
I think it's especially maligned because he had like, suddenly he was like back and making this incredible run of films, and then that movie is like not all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I haven't seen it. Like, there you go. And that's probably why.
You don't really need to bother. Yeah.
Oh, honestly, by the way, that's probably also, and I confess to it, like one of the reasons I haven't seen the Tom Ford film was because it was like, oh, fashion designer making a movie where everybody's dressed really well. I don't, my default is there's nothing going on in that movie. It's going to look really good. It's going to seem serious. Like a lot of fashion runway shows have a kind of, models have a serious look on their faces, but will it really be of serious intent? I don't know.
My wife Julie and I have a running fix it theory. Oops. Sorry, my mic got unplugged there a second. That Colin Firth and Jeff Bridges should have switched their Oscar years. So Jeff Bridges won in 2009 for Crazy Heart, which is like fine performance. But yeah. Colin Firth was really great in A Serious Man, and he should have won that year. And then Single Man. And then Jeff Bridges should have won in 2010 for True Grit, where he's great in. And Colin Firth won in King's Speech, where he's like fine.
I like that.
There's another like sideways parallel universe somewhere where that
I know.
Happened. Yeah. Apropos of nothing, a friend of mine noted that the lead singers of Midnight Oil and the B-52s could switch places and it might work. Think about it. How can we sleep while our beds are burning? Sorry.
I mean, that's just very funny because like B-52s, you know, great band, but like they're not like especially like deep political lyrics, whereas Midnight Oil are like an activist band that I just imagine.
That's right.
What's his name? Peter something from Midnight Oil?
Peter.
I imagine him, he would just feel trapped in like this.
Peter Garrett,
yeah.
Love Shack, baby. It'd be pretty amazing. By the way, Midnight Oil, anybody, if you ever get a chance to see them live, unbelievable. They're an unbelievable band. But hey, since we're talking about...
Coincidentally, I've been listening to Midnight Oil a bit lately.
Yeah, man. They're the bomb. And, you know, B-52s too. And if you want to talk about costumes, we could always talk about the B-52s. They're definitely not dressing down for the occasion.
Yeah. I saw B-52s in the 90s, a co-headlining tour with the Pretenders.
Wow.
And the opening band, a good band, but does not belong, was Royal Crown Revue, the like neo swing band, the best of the neo swing bands, but still, it was just so weird to start with that.
But they're all, that's like three different, it's interesting because they represent three different decades of style. Right. Like Chrissy Hynde was a model in the 70s. Yeah. So like she's got 70s style, then you got the 50/60 style of the B-52s, and then you have the horrific. But here's something we could talk about, because I fought hard for this. We I know that you want to wrap up, but maybe this is the thing to wrap up on. Swingers. I totally wanted to do an episode about Swingers because it is now universally maligned for its fashion. But when it came out, more than almost any of the movies that we've talked about, it had like maybe not more than Breathless probably, but like it had a huge impact on fashion instantaneously. Really? I was living in LA when that movie came out, and it was like, it was crazy, man. Like everybody was wearing bowling shirts after that movie.
I can tell you like it being like, what that's 96, so I'm like 14 or so in St. Louis. I was going to thrift stores and looking for bowling shirts after I after I saw that movie. So yeah, I can concur.
A huge and horrible, like that is something that we haven't talked about, is when a movie has an impact on fashion that is awful. Like
Bowling shirts and wallet chains.
Right. Yeah. Who's carrying this forward into today? Guy Fieri.
Yeah.
Without Swingers, would there be a Guy Fieri? Who knows? And we loved it. That's the other thing. Like, I remember that movie coming out. Everybody loved it. It got great reviews. And now you look at it and it's like, oh my God, the sexual politics in this movie, like the gender politics. What is it? And they've straight up said that they were going for like a throwback. They wanted to throw back to a time when like gender roles were more obvious and clear and stuff like that. It's just like, oh, it just doesn't work anymore. And almost any,
I don't know,
level.
I think now I'm going to be the guy defending Swingers, but I think like by the end of the movie, Vince Vaughn is revealed to be a pathetic baby.
Yes, literally.
And so I do think by the end, it ends up in the right place.
There is growth, but it's again, it's one of those things where it's like, but you're, the takeaway from that movie among people watching it at the time was not that. It was like, I want to be a Vegas swinger dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to wear those clothes.
Well, I mean, wouldn't be the first time people took the wrong message movie completely, you know?
Is it the filmmaker's fault? That's true.
You know, the number of people who think that, like, I don't know, who am I thinking of? I wanted to say Tony Soprano, but this is a movie podcast. So let's say like Henry Hill or whatever. People who think Goodfellas is aspirational.
Hey, this is. Did you see this New York Times article though? There's now, if we're talking about fashion, there's apparently this whole like trend of mob wife.
Oh yeah.
I don't get it, but like everything has its moment.
Yeah. I thought Miley Cyrus looked great at the Grammys. I don't know if that was a mob wife thing, but I did like.
I'm looking it up right now.
Okay, well, we'll get ready to wrap up while, and we'll be interrupted by your reaction to Miley Cyrus at the Grammys.
Go.
Okay, you can find Battleship. You can find us at battleshipretention.com. You can email me at david@battleshippretention.com or tyler@battleshippretention.com. Follow me on Twitter or Blue Sky at Davey Pretension, on Letterboxd at David Backs. Tyler's on Twitter at More Lessons. My other podcast, it's about TV. It's called The One Where I Met Your Mother. It's my wife and I watching Friends and How I Met Your Mother together. That's that. Scott, what do you have to plug?
Same stuff. Twitter, Blue Sky, at Rail of Tomorrow. I don't have anything new up on the website since the last couple episodes, but I just got a notification from UPS that something from Criterion will come in the mail soon. So I will shortly have something on the website.
Nice.
And yeah, that's about it.
Okay. Rico, what do you think of Miley Cyrus at the Grammys?
I see it. I definitely, the hair is definitely looking mob wife, and she looks good. You know?
Yeah, I think she looks great there.
It is always interesting to me that moment when styles change and you go like, really, that doesn't look good. And then somehow you find yourself 2 months later going like, you know, it's not bad.
Yeah.
How does it happen? And you can find me on Threads. I'm not doing Twitter these days. Threads, Rico Galliano, RicoGagliano, and also Instagram. Same thing.
At first, I forgot that Threads was a social media platform. I thought you were just being clever with like what we're talking about this episode.
Right.
It happens to also be symbolic of what we're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
And check out the movie podcast, right?
Yes.
Wherever you find podcasts.
Yes. It's a documentary style show, not just, although we do interview famous filmmakers in between. But if you're looking for like a deep dive into some movies, go check it out.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, Rico.
Thank you for having me. That was a delightful combo.
And thank you at home for listening.
And we'll get you next time.
All right. Bye.